Welcome once again, folks, to All Things Trek. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
And we're talking about Star Trek.
Indeed, as we always do here on allthingstrek.com.
Yup.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about some prime directives, because last week we had a lot of fun, and that was what we made our decision on. We're also going to get into...
Arbitrarily.
Well, I asked you what you
want. Bob, what are we talking about next week? I like the prime directive.
I'm tired of making all the decisions, Bob. This is your track. But first, I wanted to make known that, for all of our loyal listeners, however many we have, that I'm probably going to be running a Star Trek RPG at some point in the future. And Bob is going to be in it. He's going to be the chief engineer. I have no idea who else is going to be in it at the moment. But if and when this ends up happening, I will definitely give weekly updates about it on the podcast. If it becomes big enough, I might even give it its own podcast.
We should videocast it.
Oh goodness!
Yeah.
Oh boy, we are up. That's going to require us to up our game.
We're going to have to get a camera.
Yeah, but I'm excited because it's all about. It's going to be like set in like I'm thinking maybe the Gorn border because I feel like the Gorn never get enough love.
They don't.
Star Trek.
I wish there was more space dinosaur action.
Yeah, I need me some space dinosaurs, and the characters are probably going to be in command of an Okinawa class from Starfleet Command 2. I love that little ship.
I had to show it to him. I'm like, well, I don't want to be on an Oberth. How about an Okinawa? That's kind of about the same size. What the fuck's an Okinawa?
Yeah. And setting this at, like, Enterprise C time period, so probably, like, 2340, which is about 4 years before the Battle of Narondra 3, if we want to get into dates. So anyway, I'm excited about that.
I'm excited. An engineer thinks so hard.
Yeah, my biggest obstacle at this point is finding someone to play the captain, but I'll solve that eventually. And I'm probably going to have everyone have two sets of characters, like one set will be like the command staff, and then the other set will be like field specialists that go out on away missions, because I think that, you know, that way we don't have to do the silly thing of like, why are all the bridge officers on this routine away mission? That doesn't make sense. And then, of course, I'm also house ruling pockets and seatbelts into Star Trek.
Nah, bro, it's cool. We don't need pockets or seatbelts.
I think we need both of those things.
Nah, that's cool.
Also, for reference, there will be no exploding consoles in my game. The console's not going to explode. There's no reason.
You could just put a circuit breaker on every deck in every room. I think that would fix that.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's pretty basic. Like, if the bridge gets hit, the bridge will explode.
But the
console won't. Okay, so, prime directive. Oh, one more thing. I am planning on making more Tales from the DMZ episodes for anyone who's missing those. I have a fourth episode plan that I'm really excited about, but these things take time, and so it may be a while, but eventually there will be more.
They're coming. They'll happen.
All right, so Prime Directive.
Yeah.
So what is the Prime Directive, Bob?
Prime Directive is an awesome policy that's been instated by Starfleet.
Is it, really?
Yeah, it's okay. So rad.
Because I was going to say it sort of depends on which episode and which series you happen to be watching.
Nope, all time, all good.
But it's usually depicted in its most basic form as a doctrine of non-interference. And it is, a number of people on the internet and off the internet have pointed out various, like, weird flaws and inconsistencies with the Prime Directive. And so we want to take a look at it on a series-by-series basis and see what it's all about.
Absolutely.
And, like, so first you have to look at how each series handled it. And when it was first introduced in TOS, it was clearly a shield of, like, designed to protect developing civilizations from interference by the Federation. And you have to see this is sort of born out of the policies of the United States at the time. We were, you know, headlong in the Vietnam War when this was all going on, and a lot of people saw that as a conflict where we were interfering in somewhere we had no business being, and that it was making everything worse all around. And so it was kind of a response to that sort of policy. And then, of course,
In the original series.
And then, of course, the worldwide exploitation of less technologically advanced cultures by more technologically advanced ones. And, you know, we have plenty of examples of that right here in the United States.
Sure.
And so that's, you know, and so it's understandable that Gene Roddenberry writing about a utopian future would have that kind of policy to prevent that sort of thing from happening. And the way it's used in the original series makes a fair amount of sense. And then from a dramatic standpoint, it was also a way of testing the humanity of our characters, because it's more interesting when if the mission of the day is to help some people out, it's more interesting if there's a potential risk because they might be violating a law by doing it, because they might be interfering, and the Prime Directive says you're not supposed to do that.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's more interesting than just being like, oh, I guess we're going to help these people. We helped them. Going home.
Going home.
And it shows that Kirk and company are willing to take personal risks in the name of doing good. And so, right. You know, it all works out fairly well. And the Prime Directive, even at that point, was fairly reasonable. The first episode I remember it being mentioned in, and canonically this isn't actually the first place it was mentioned, but the first one that I remember, and I didn't think to write this the name of this episode down, but the one where they find a civilization that's inside an asteroid, and they, basically, the civilization doesn't know. Do you remember that episode, Bob?
Inside of an asteroid, in yeah. TOS?
Yeah, in TOS, there's this giant asteroid, like, floating through space, and it turns out it's actually a spaceship. That looks like an asteroid.
This one does not sound familiar at all. Like, TOS. I remember there was a TAS episode like that.
Oh, you mean the animated series?
Yeah.
No, trust me, this was original series. This was not animated.
Inside of an asteroid. What a novel idea.
Well, because, it wasn't an asteroid. It was a spaceship that looked like an asteroid. But, like, it was a generation ship. It was, like, a colony ship that was going to take... That took, like, multiple generations to get where it was going. And the people inside the ship didn't know it was a spaceship. Like, they just thought they lived underground.
This is not ringing any bells.
Okay, well, this is real. Okay. And so something bad...
We're going to have to Wikipedia that later.
We will. And something bad is going to happen to it. And so Kirk is like, all right, well, we're going to help them fix the ship. We're going to help them not, you know, not get exploded. And in order to do that, we have to explain to them that they are, you know, in an asteroid and in a spaceship and not just underground. And Spock points out that that might... violate the Prime Directive about non-interference, and Kirk counters with, well, it might, but...
Wait, is this the episode for I Am Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, maybe that's
the one.
That
sounds familiar.
That's, like, I think the only one I haven't seen. I'm trying, like, running through the database, like, what one have I not seen? It's like, I think it's that one.
See, you're way more pro at remembering episode names than I am. See, to me, I just remember them by, like, what basically happens. Like, oh, that's the one with the asteroid spaceship. This is the one with the skeevy businessman. That's the one with where McCoy goes back in time and saves a woman from dying. You know, that's how I remember the episodes.
Nah, bro. Street names. Street names.
Street names? Okay.
Street names. Not landmarks. Street names. That's how I navigate.
Fair enough. And, you know, and Kirk counters to Spock's point by saying, well, you know, this is, sure, it's interfering, but it's interfering to save them from extinction. So, it makes sense. And it's something that they're going to do. And the implication is that even though this is a little risky, the Prime Directive allows this sort of thing at the captain's judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and then it all works out. It's a good episode. And then it happens again, or it may have happened previously, actually. I forget the exact order, in The Return of the Archons, which is a really kind of creepy episode where they go to a planet that, like, everyone is
Landru.
Landru. Everyone is part of the body, which is a clear reference to the body politic from Marxist political theory. Woo! I'm referencing Marxist political theory.
You're throwing some big ideas out there. Big ideas.
But again, in that instance, I believe it is Spock brings up that interfering in this culture's natural, in their natural course, may be against the Prime Directive, and Kirk considers that, and he decides, and this one is a little weird, but he decides that the Prime Directive only applies to civilizations that are developing, whereas this one is stuck in a constant stagnation because they're ruled by a computer called Landru. And so again, it's a rule that tests the humanity of the characters, but, you know, it makes sense as a policy. And so then you get into... TNG, and that's where it starts to take a bit of a left turn into weird.
There's way more in TOS, though. There's the Omega Glory, right?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
because okay.
We have the Holmes and the Yangs, right?
Right, right.
Where it was like Clone Earth, remember?
Okay, that is one of the Clone Earths. All right,
where it was Captain Tracy who went down there and was like, oh man. Oh, my crew just died on the ship or whatever. Oh, my goodness, there's some sort of sickness here. But wait, these people have lived for, like, hundreds of years. I've found the Fountain of Youth. Oh, this is so awesome. I'm going to help these people out or try to figure out what's going on down this planet's surface.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can get this, like, you know, immortality potion going on all up in.
Yeah, I remember that as the episode.
Right, and then, like, when they initially got there, he was helping out the Yangs by gunning down a bunch of Combs with
his
phasers.
Other way around.
Was it? Was it the Combs? He was helping the Combs out and gunning down a bunch of Yangs with his phasers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what was going on with that. But clear Prime Directive violation on Tracy's part.
Right.
With that.
And again, you know, that episode clearly illustrates what the Prime Directive is there to stop.
Exactly.
Because it's like, you know, the Starfleet officer is just murdering a bunch of people with his space laser, mm-hmm. And there's nothing to, and, you know, and he's really disrupting this planet. Yep. And causing a bunch of harm, and he's not supposed to do that sort of thing, and he's not doing it to help anyone other than himself. And it's, you know, he thinks that himself and the Federation can, I don't even know if it was called the Federation yet at that point in the series, but, you know, then he thinks...
Totally Federation.
Was it the Federation by then? Yeah. I don't remember when they actually started using the term Federation, but I believe it. So they had
a UFP flag that was really rad earlier in the series.
I do like the UFP.
I don't remember what it was being used for, but there was just this like little flag on a pole, and they were like so proud of this flag on a pole they were putting on this planet's surface. Like, yeah, UFP, woo!
Or the
it was such a sad little flag.
The UFPA, as I like the to UFPA, call it. Yeah. The UFPA. So yeah, this captain thought that he and the UFPA could benefit at the expense of these people, effectively. And, you know, he was thinking of it from, like, he thought he was doing good, but isn't it then later revealed that he intentionally let his crew die because they objected to what he was doing?
I don't remember that detail, if that was in there or not. I know that the crew who had gone down, the original landing party, had gone back up to the ship, and they contacted the captain saying, hey, there's this horrible disease nonsense from the planet going on, mm-hmm. and it's killing people. And Tracy's like, well, that's no good.
I remember...
So Tracy didn't go back, I know that.
Yeah, I remember there being...
Because the landing party went over the ship and was like, oh man, there's just like piles of goo everywhere, which is like little like salt clumps inside of the uniforms or so. Then they went down to the planet's surface where they found Tracy.
Which, incidentally, I'm fairly certain if you pull all the water out of a person, you'd be left with a lot more than a pile of salt.
And...
But to be... I'm also glad that we didn't see that.
You know, 1960s, you know.
Box of salt is cheap. Pile of desiccated human remains, not so much.
Yep. But then we got Kirk going down with, you know, Spock, McCoy, and Ensign Ricky, mm-hmm. you know, the red shirt. And, or maybe there wasn't a red shirt in that one. I don't remember. But anyway, they go back down, they go to the planet surface after they get on the, Exeter.
Yeah.
And, they go down there, they have their adventure, and then near the end of the episode where Kirk has to fight Tracy, he picks up, like, what's the document? It's not the Constitution, is it?
No, I think it is.
Is it the Constitution?
It's the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, but it's like reverse Prime Directive. It's like, you guys are totally this, and
right.
helping them progress, as opposed to being destructive or so, like introducing much technology. He's making them see what they've got already.
Right, which is so, a copy of the...
But my question is that actually a Prime Directive violation, though?
What Kirk does at the end?
Yeah.
I would say not, if only...
Hey guys, you wrote this, by the way.
I would say not, if only because by that point, Tracy has already violated the Prime Directive so badly that what Kirk is doing, I think, would be an example of trying to repair some of the damage that Tracy has caused. Would be my assumption. Although, then again, it seems that, like, if Tracy hadn't been there, the Yangs would have overrun the Comb village anyway, and they make... And probably would have done it much faster because he was like, you know, the thing that I wasn't sure about was if the Yangs were planning to attack the Comb village in any case, or if Tracy instigated that by shooting a bunch of them with phasers. And that's something I don't think we'll ever know the answer to. If they were planning to attack the village anyway, then all he did was delay the inevitable.
I think there was also some sort of blood and thunder Yang speech that went on with, there being, oh man, they have fireboxes, but we don't care about their fireboxes. Ah!
Yeah, there's like a million of us.
Firebox being phaser, for those that didn't catch that.
Firebox!
Yep.
And so, but in that instance, if that was the case, then I think that, yes, what Kirk did probably does count as a Prime Directive violation, because he's basically, like, the, you know, the Yangs are probably about to murder all the Combs, because they seem pretty upset. And he steps in and is like, no, you shouldn't, because you have this document. Let me explain to you what it means. but I think at that point, because the Prime Directive had already been violated so badly, I think that Starfleet would probably be inclined to look favorably on his actions.
Just hand-wave that one.
And I imagine that Kirk could justify it fairly easily by just saying what I said, that, you know, that Tracy instigated this fight by shooting a bunch of Yangs with phasers. and that he was trying to repair the damage. Whether or not that was actually true.
Hey, Admiral, look, this Captain Tracy over here already went down with phasers blazing. I was just trying to clean up the mess.
Plus, you know, Kirk is made of Teflon when it comes to Starfleet regulations. Nothing sticks to him. The only time Kirk has ever been reprimanded that I can recall is Star Trek IV, mm-hmm. where it's like, you know, okay, I guess we'll demote you to captain. I was already a captain. That's basically what I did. I mean, I know I had the rank of admiral before, but I never actually did the job.
Yep. There's also another cleanup episode that they have to deal with.
Which one is it?
A Piece of the Action.
Oh, right.
Where they go to, I think it's called Iosha 3.
I do love that episode.
Where it's like mobster, gangster style. The entire planet's that way or some such. Because the USS Horizon, actually I don't think it was even called USS, I think it was just SS Horizon at that point, had come like 100 years earlier and had decided to leave, of all things, a book all about like New York gangs or like about gangs and...
I think it was a novel even. It wasn't like...
No, it was like a giant tome. It was like... For those that can't see, I'm holding my hands up about 3 by 3, 3 feet by 3 feet.
Was it? Because I thought I thought it was supposed to be a fictional account. I could be wrong, but like I thought that was their explanation for why the gangsters were so over the top and crazy.
No, it was like an actual like history like text thing that they had just the ship had just come along, visited the planets, and here you go. It's just like why'd you leave this? I don't understand. Well,
you saw how big it was. They needed to get rid of some ballast.
This was a big book. It's true. Those old 2160 starships couldn't carry much.
And then, of course, it was the planet of mimics, so they based their entire civilization around this book.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, the other potential... you remember the DS9 episode, Trials and Tribulations?
Yes.
Well, the other episode they were considering for that slot... was going to be them going back to that planet and have it be an entire planet of Spock, Kirk, and McCoy.
What?
Yeah, because, you know, they had this the most important thing that had ever happened in their culture, in their history at that point, was the leaving of the book by the Horizon, and then Kirk, Spock, and McCoy showing up and telling them they were doing it wrong. And so it was going to be an entire, like it was, I think in the words of whoever it was who was talking about on the DVD, maybe Ron Moore, was that it was going to be an entire planet of Star Trek fans.
This sounds like a dumb episode.
I don't know. I think it would have been funny. But, I mean, just a little bit of trivia regarding that episode. So, does that episode really count as a Prime Directive episode? I mean...
Well, yeah, because they suddenly come across this planet, like, what on earth is going on here? Why is this planet like this? And then they go figure out, oh, it's because the Horizon had come earlier.
Right, right.
And had done all this nonsense. Now, 2160s, from what I read of, you know, the episode synopsis and all that good stuff, is approximately 10 years after Enterprise. The Enterprise ended in 2154, right?
Something like that. I honestly didn't pay that much attention to Enterprise's timeline.
Okay, so, anyway, this is about 10 years after Enterprise.
Incidentally, Bob is way better with Star Trek dates than I am.
So this is about 10 years after Dear Doctor.
Yeah.
Or the Dear Doctor episode we had going on. Ooh. We were talking about, at some point, they're going to institute a doctor, and they'll tell me what I can and can't do out here. So it's interesting to kind of think about, you know, is that actually being hashed out yet, or are they still thinking about it? Because I would like to think that it had been hashed out already, but, like, news didn't get out to the Horizon fast enough when they were out in space, and they just dropped off this book.
Like, I mean, sup, guys, book.
I mean, to be fair, that like, the Horizon crew and whatnot, they didn't know necessarily that they would just suddenly, like, look at the book at how to live their lives and how to model their planet after it. Like, they didn't know that was going to happen.
Now, what I want to know is if the book had, like, technical schematics for gangster like cars and Tommy guns, or if they just intuited how to make those.
There's pictures on them and whatnot.
It's like, you know, these are the materials you need to make a car. This is plans for an internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, so that's something that I was a little unsure about. And I guess there is some Prime Directive stuff because they aren't allowed to just blast their way in and free because, you know, Kirk and Spock and McCoy get taken prisoner and who's it back in command of the ship? Is it Sulu?
I think it's Scotty.
It's Scotty? I forget, because Sulu used to be the one they left in charge, and then they started leaving Scotty in charge.
Really? I don't know.
Yeah, early TOS had Sulu was the one they left in charge.
Huh, interesting.
I don't know when they decided to make the change. I guess they decided that the chief engineer, the last place that he should be is in engineering.
I don't know, I see him on the bridge a lot.
Yeah. Anyway, whoever it was they left in charge back on the ship couldn't just blast in there, couldn't set their phasers to stun and stun the entire planet.
Well, they'd stun the block right there, remember?
Yeah.
I mean, so ship phasers can be set to stun for those inquiring minds that would like to know.
That's something I find kind of hilarious.
Yep.
Sounds like a very useful tool for, like, pacifying an angry mob.
Riot Control.
Go to sleep.
I need a starship over at 5th and Broadway.
Look, I imagine that Riot Control in the future is a piece of cake. They just have, like, off guns. A phaser on stun setting knocks out a human, like, you know, with one shot, no matter where you hit them, and it has, like, no permanent side effects.
Yep.
It's not even like a taser that can, like, kill you if you have a heart condition or something.
Yep.
Nope.
There's two others in TOS. There's A Private Little War. You remember that one?
Is that the one with... No.
Okay, so...
Tell me what happens, and I'll remember.
I don't know why they're going here, but there's this planet they're going to that Kirk had gone to when he was a lieutenant serving on the USS Farragut. And he had befriended some of the locals there at one point, for God knows what reason, or at least one of them.
Yeah.
And he was, like, friends and buddies with them. Now, this buddy of his on this planet, they're living in, like, maybe the Bronze Age. Bronze Age type tech.
Oh, wait, is this the one with, like, the giant guys who have, like, the three-pointed knife that returns to them?
No. You're thinking of... Friday's Child.
Okay.
Is the one I think you're thinking of.
Yes, I am thinking.
Which actually, okay, so there's three others, actually. I'm sorry, including this one. A Private Little War. Anyway, so they return to this planet with the Enterprise for whatever reason. I'm not really quite sure why. He meets his buddy. I don't remember what his buddy's name is. And as they're spending more time on the surface, they come to realize that, like, this rival, like, town or so is in, like, the industrial era, while these guys are still hanging out in, like, the Bronze Age. And they do some investigating, and they find out the Klingons have been giving them, like, a bunch of technology.
Yes, I remember that.
Right? And then Kirk's like, no, that's not cool, guys. That's
one,
not cool.
That's the one where a lady seduces Kirk for his phaser, and that's not a euphemism.
Right. Exactly. He seduces him for his phaser by making implications about his phaser.
Now you're
with
crossed.
Motion.
Yeah, okay.
That's the thing that happened. Anyway, and then near the end of the episode, after they've done, like, let's investigate, and they're trying to fix the problem, Kirk calls up the ship and is like, hey, I need, like, a bunch of muskets for these guys, Scotty. And Scotty's like, what? You want me to what? And Kirk's like, never mind, I'm not saying nothing about that anymore.
Well, I think if only because...
It's like there wasn't really any resolution because they just kind of up and left at that point.
Well, that episode was, I think, an even a direct response to the whole idea of Vietnam and proxy wars, because they even have, like, Kirk and McCoy even have a a discussion about it where, like, Kirk's saying, we're going to arm our friends while the Klingons arm theirs. And McCoy's like, no, we shouldn't do that. They did that on Earth and it sucked.
Yeah.
It sucked a lot.
It did suck a lot. But, I mean, there was... I didn't quite catch what exactly the whole reason was, because the Klingons weren't coming and trying to take over the planet. Maybe they were. But, I mean, there wasn't any indicated Federation interest in the planet at all. Other than that, Klingons are there.
As I recall, it was that the planet had either some strategic significance or some kind of resources, and there was a treaty that stopped the Klingons from just landing on it. And so they were pushing their own puppet faction.
Oh, right, okay.
That's what I recall it being.
All right, that makes sense.
And I can't for the life of me remember if they resolved that or not, or if they just left and basically handed the world to the Klingons. Because that seems a little bit...
Well, I think they took care of we only saw, like, a singular Klingon there, I think, and there was a Klingon scout ship in orbit or something like that they were dealing with, or maybe that's also Friday's Child I'm thinking of.
I remember
Klingon talking to other dude, and there was guns involved.
Well, this was pretty much the exact same story in Friday's Child, except Friday's Child featured McCoy smacking a woman around. and that part was much more central, but...
There was no active, necessarily, participation. There was no overt participation with the local culture in A Private Little War, as opposed to Friday's Child. Which Friday's Child is just like, yeah, guys, we're here now, we want your minerals. In Private Little War, it's very much where the Klingons are being very secretive with this other, like, tribe, whereas, as is Kirk with, you know, his tribe, mm-hmm. you know, or his friend's tribe. You know, it's very much like, you know, very much a secretive proxy war, is like how you described it earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, you know, we're not going to tell anybody we're doing this, but this is a thing happening now. Whereas Friday's Child, there are Klingons there, and the Federation is there, with the Capellans who have their, like, boomerang knives, I think is what you want to call them.
Yeah, boomerang knives.
Of course, I didn't really see them return after they stuck in somebody, though.
Yeah, they returned once.
Did they?
They don't return if you hit. They return if you miss.
Oh, okay.
It's a thing. Did you get it? There's a fly buzzing around in here. Bob is trying to murder it.
I am trying to murder it. I'm not sure I got it, though.
The Prime Directive would frown on that.
No. Fuck the Prime Directive. I'm going to break your window. Never mind. All right.
Don't break my window.
I'll die well.
Okay. So anyway, yeah, so I think that those situations are, like, really what the Prime Directive is for, which is that they complicate, complicate a dramatic situation and mm-hmm. make it trickier to resolve.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's like, you know, it's a situation where the characters have to deal with this problem without compromising their principles. And they usually manage to in TOS because their principles are not unreasonable. Like, their principles are restrictive, but not, you know, but not crazy.
Yep. So there's one other episode that will segue nicely, I think, into TNG.
Okay.
From TOS. And that is the one, I don't remember the name of it, it's shocking, I know, where, I don't remember what the circumstances were, but they go to this planet, and they beam down, and then Kirk suddenly somehow becomes one of the natives. It's like, he suddenly got explosive case amnesia.
Oh, right! The planet full of Indians.
Yeah. And he just starts hanging out with them, and he, like, takes a wife or a girlfriend or whatever.
Yeah, I remember that.
And the Enterprise, like, just runs off to deal with this asteroid that's hurtling towards this planet.
Yeah, he spends, like 3 months living there thinking he's one of them.
Yeah, you know, it's like, what on earth is going on? And, but the point I want to make is, because we see this in TNG with, like, natural disasters and such, is that there's this asteroid hurtling towards this planet and is going to obliterate everything on it.
Yeah, and then,
and they just took this huge interest in, like, oh man, we don't want this to happen at all, this planet, or these people. This is a bad thing. Let's deal with this. And they start, like, trying to phaser the rock and blow it up and stuff. And they managed to do so, I think, in, like, the 11th hour.
Yeah, well, because it's a timer of, like, they're trying to find Kirk, and they're also, like, there's, like, something going on the ship that's, like, stopping them from, like, solving this problem easily, and, like, making it, like, Kirk...
Well,
like,
I think it was because the rock was just so huge.
Yeah, and, like, Spock and McCoy are, like, that episode, I think, is good for the way that Spock and McCoy, like, interact. Like, Kirk's whole thing on the planet is really goofy.
Yeah, it is.
And,
I have found myself. I am free with running with the buffalo.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm sorry, that was racist of me. I won't.
Well, the episode is pretty racist.
Might have been an attempt to get the Western crowd involved, because a lot of Westerns were being made in that time.
Well, that's true.
Because they're easy to do.
And of course, yeah, and Gene Roddenberry did want to be very ethnically diverse. In this instance, I'm not sure that was the way to go about it. Because, you know, hey guys, so let's have an episode about some Native Americans. All right, what are the Native Americans doing? Well, they're sitting around waiting to get wiped out by a rock. Well, you know, Kirk comes and not only saves them, but in the process also becomes the best Native American.
The best Native.
Because he has to fight the best Native American and wins, and by, you know, wins the title.
Is there that whole cliche of, like, I gotta fight for the, like, Indian chief's daughter thing?
Yeah, you know? Basically. He like, marries a woman, and the woman's jilted boyfriend is mad, and, like, fights Kirk, and he's, like, the one who's supposed to know the secrets of the Protect This Planet from Rocks temple that the planet has, but he doesn't, because his dad never told him.
That's right. That's what blows it up. Not the Enterprise, but the obelisk thing.
Yeah, and so, like, Kirk has to try to figure out how to open it, and this guy's mad because Kirk is being, you know, cool, so he has to fight Kirk.
Yep.
That episode, despite its racist nature, does illustrate clearly that Starfleet isn't just going to let, you know, a bunch of people get wiped out by an asteroid.
All right, now we shift into TNG.
Oh, goodness. and the first TNG episode where the Prime Directive really comes up is Pen Pals.
Oh, man.
Where they are prepared to let a planet get wiped out by huge earthquakes. And they're like, no, we can't stop it.
We can't help this.
That would be interfering. And it's just like, I like Pen Pals. Like, I do, but because it's well presented, but it's just, their arguments for not helping these people are so absurd.
They are pretty dumb.
Like, Riker even brings up that there might be a cosmic plan, and if there is a cosmic plan, that it may be these people's place to die in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, what? I mean, that logic is so, like, it's facetious? Fallacious?
Just call it flawed.
It's so flawed, it's like, you can just see the obvious flaws in it. It's like, alright, so even... Like, accepting that there is a cosmic plan, Let's assume that there is one.
Mm-hmm.
You have no way of knowing it. And yep. So the only logical course is to do what you would do normally.
Right, exactly. Because if you didn't know there'd be a cosmic plan anyway, yeah, or had the thought of one.
I mean, by definition, if there is a cosmic plan, then your actions are part of that cosmic plan, right?
Exactly.
It's the silliest argument I've ever heard. Maybe not the silliest. We haven't gotten to Dear Doctor yet.
Yeah, we're almost there. We'll get there. But yeah.
But TNG... Like, TMG's interpretation of the Prime Directive, and they did this again in, let's see, which episode was that? It was it Homecoming? It was the episode with Worf's brother.
Homeward,
yeah. And they did the exact same thing. They're not gonna save these people from extinction because it would be interfering. And it's like...
Well, there are different levels of the interference here, keep in mind. With the Native Americans and TOS... There was an asteroid in space, and they were trying to blow it up in space, right?
Yeah.
With pen pals, there's geological instability in the planet, which they did fix. They did fix that, thanks to Wesley Crusher's science project thingamajig yes. that he was doing with the other crew members or so, the B-cast, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, the people who want to study comets.
Right, that's the thing that could be fixed. Those are things that they could actually fix. Then there was Homeward. Which there was this atmospheric problem going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they could have fixed it or not, but the way that they would have been able to save the populace was to actually bring them onto the ship, right? Which is what they ended up doing.
Yes.
Or at least that's what Worf's brother
forced them to do it.
It's true. I don't know if there was actually any science they could actually, like, put on the planet to make it be better or whatnot, but... So there's these different levels of interference, I feel, that are taking place... that form that gray area of the Prime Directive that makes it, you know, harder for the characters to make these choices to enact or not enact the Prime Directive on people when right. it comes to this extinction-type stuff.
And it's important to note that even though The Next Generation does have this bizarre turn into like, non-interference at any cost, even, you know, even at the cost of extinction, it's the characters always do it anyway. Because the characters are, in the end, decent human beings, except Riker, apparently.
There's a plan, I'm not gonna fool with it. What? how do you know what the plan is?
But because they're decent human beings, or decent Klingon beings, or what have you, they always do the right thing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, if I had to guess, I would say that this whole reinterpretation of the Prime Directive... is along with the sort of New Age philosophy that humans mess up everything they touch. And, you know, to be fair, we do mess up a lot of things that we touch.
Yep.
You know, I consider myself an environmentalist, and I'm, you know, constantly appalled by every new story of the week about how we're messing up the environment that we live in and all that stuff. And, you know, that's no good.
Michelle Bach wants to drill in the Everglades.
The Everglades, huh?
The Everglades.
Well, she's going to get eaten by alligators, let me tell you. I've been down there. Alligators all over the place. But in this instance, this is like taking it like... And if you notice, like, Gene Roddenberry got really New Agey with the next generation. And... Like, you know, whereas in TOS, even though TOS is all about, like, cultural acceptance and not being racist, it's still very pro-American. Mm-hmm. It's obviously all about pushing American values.
Sure.
And, you know, that's to be expected. It was in the 60s. But in The Next Generation, it's sort of shifted and become this almost... This is ironic for a space opera, but I would almost describe early Next Generation as being a back-to-nature show.
Didn't you mention, I don't know if it was on the show or not, but they had one to put dolphins on the ship?
Yeah, I heard, I'm not positive about this. This is something I heard from SF Debris, that supposedly there was an original plan to have certain parts of the ship filled with water so that dolphins could be on it.
To navigate dolphins or something?
Dolphins and whales, yeah, to help them navigate.
I don't even know how that works, but okay.
I'm glad that they didn't do that. Also, and this apparently had nothing to do with Roddenberry, there was also apparently not going to be an engineering section originally. This was something that Roddenberry had to fight to keep in. I don't know why. I don't know what the network's reasoning on that was.
Well, they probably didn't want to build a set and spend money on it. Was the reasoning?
That's probably true.
You can't have your warp core because we don't want to spend money on it.
It's a tube.
But people want to see the ship go.
We need a tube with lights in it. But what I was saying about the Next Generation is that it's gone into this idea that the way that it fulfills this idea that the way humans should interact with nature is to not. And it's like, so, you know, the idea being that, like, any human interference is going to be bad, regardless of why it's being done or for what cause, which is where this whole idea of non-interference at all cost comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's, you know, to quote Obi-Wan Kenobi, only a Sith deals in absolutes.
Ooh, my goodness.
Which
I don't like where this conversation's going, or
which I feel is very, very appropriate for this discussion.
Oh, my goodness.
Because it's a, you know, it's a complete and total rule with no exceptions based on circumstances, and that sort of law is not going to be helpful. You know, it's not going to be what you need, because there are going to be situations that the people who wrote this law didn't plan for. And the Next Generation is also...
Yeah, there are 47 amendments, supposedly, to the Prime Directive.
Yeah, I've heard them say that, but because we never find out what those amendments are or what they could possibly be, I'm not going to worry...
If your name is Kirk, you don't worry about it.
I'm not going to worry about it because they say that, but it doesn't actually mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's like how the... My favorite meaningless numbers in law is when... Is in one Voyager episode where Janeway says that, like, the handbook on interspecies romance is something like 100 pages thick. And I'm like, I agree with Sci-Fi Debris. It's like, how many ways to say don't have sex with alien life forms unless it's safe are there?
Not enough is always the answer.
Is it a guidebook?
I don't know about that, but... what are some other instances in TNG where we've got...
Well, a good TNG Prime Directive episode is Who Watches the Watchers?
Oh, yeah, with, like, the... Like, wannabe Romulans or whatever?
Wannabe Vulcans.
Wannabe Vulcans. I think they had pretty prominent brows.
I think they even mentioned that they're, like, proto-Vulcans. I think that's actually a thing. My favorite part of that episode is that they are, like, you know, they're, like, hunter-gatherer by that point. They have bows, but, like...
They're, like, you know, late tool age.
Yeah, but, like, their bows, if you look at them, are clearly... compound hunting bows that
it's
like
true.
Someone bought at a best at a big five and then they put some furs on them to try to disguise it. It's like, I can see the pulleys. That is a very advanced bow you have there,
so
ma'am.
Advanced.
But that episode is really good because it shows the actual potential dangers of interacting with a less advanced less technologically advanced, I should say, civilization.
Right.
Even when no harm is intended. And it also shows that the lengths that the characters are willing to go to protect this developing civilization and hope and make sure that it doesn't, like, ruin itself because of contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this is a, you know, I feel like it's a pretty clear example of, it's a pretty clear, like, I'd say reaction to instances in human history where two cultures have met. And even if the intent was not hostile, very often one culture has been destroyed as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Very often it's by biological means, like the transference of disease. But just as often it's a cultural extinction.
Right.
Especially if one culture is, like, much, much larger than the other. The other culture can't maintain their cultural identity. And, you know, that's... Every once in a while we even get that in the modern day when every once in a while they, like, you know, you stumble on a quote lost tribe, unquote,
mm-hmm.
which is like, you know, any group of people that lives more or less cut off from the modern world. And of course, because they're such a novelty nowadays, if they're discovered and, like, action isn't taken to protect them, then everyone floods in to see them. And that basically ruins, you know, what they had going on. And very often, like, literally drives them to extinction because they have no immunity to diseases that we all carry and stuff like that. And Who Watches the Watchers, I think, is a really good example of that, and I really wish that other Prime Directive episodes had been like that one, because that one was actually good.
Well, that was very accidental exposure, though.
Yes.
Is what that was, because they had the duck blind set up when, like, you know, that rock face, whatever it was, the holographic projection in front of it, and then the reactor failed, because they're using, you know, one from, you know, Gary's outlet or something. I don't know what's going on.
Discount price.
Something. I don't know. Like, the Federation Science Call was just like, here's a hand-me-down from the other station we use or something. I don't know. But reactor fails, they come over, the Enterprise comes over and tries to fix everything, but, like, it's open, exposed, and one of the natives sees it, goes up there, and gets shocked by one of the panels, because all the panels are charged for whatever reason around the outside of the station.
Well, I always charge all my panels.
Oh, my goodness.
If someone touches the side of my house, they will get shocked, let me tell you.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Anyway... And then he gets tossed off the side of the cliff there, and they decide to beam him up to the ship to fix him. and they can't erase his memory, and he's put back down the planet's surface, where he starts telling people, oh man, I was in this place where there was the Picard, and he gave me my life back. Mm-hmm. And that's when this, you know, whole, like, religious thing almost got started right there, and Picard's like, no, I can't be a god, not cool.
In true Picardian fashion, he solved it by getting shot with an arrow.
It's true, he did get shot by an arrow to prove that he was a god.
Pretty badass.
Yeah. But first he sends, like, Riker and Troy down there to find one of the other crew members from the station. Yeah,
Palmer.
To find Palmer and whatnot, and it just becomes this huge mess. So messy. I really think it would have been better just to let the guy die.
Yeah.
I really think it would have been better just to let him die.
To be fair, they thought they were going to erase his memory.
They thought, but, you know.
Didn't work. I also really liked that episode because it showed some of the inherent problems with, like, with getting really, really literal on like belief in supernatural beings, because suddenly like everything that happens is a sign from the gods, and it's like, well, you know, what is it? And you know, it's like, and this person just is interpreting them in the worst way possible, because he's all like, you know, he's clearly got a lot that character, that native guy, is carrying around a lot of baggage because his wife's dead from the last flood
or something,
and because his wife died. And so, you know, that's a clear example of why you have to be careful with that, with interpreting the things that happen as like signs, because, you know, how you interpret them really is all that is what really matters.
Yup. Now, was this one of the episodes where, because there was some injured dude on the ground, Beverly Crusher went over and was like, oh my gosh, we need to help him? Was this one of those episodes?
No, I don't think so.
Really?
I don't remember Beverly Crusher being very important in that episode, and I certainly don't remember her telling Picard how to do his business. I'm pretty sure...
Because now you need to watch it and see who actually insists on beaming him up.
Yeah, maybe it was Crusher. I mean, that's something...
Typically, it is Crusher.
Yeah, you know, with her pesky Hippocratic Oath and need to save lives and stuff that. That probably costs way more lives than it solves. Although, let me tell you... between Who Watches the Watchers and Insurrection and probably a couple of other episodes, I've come to the determination that operating a duck blind is, like, one of the most dangerous jobs in the Federation.
Between hand-me-down equipment and rogue androids.
Yeah, they're always failing, and then the natives are getting all up in. It's problematic. I would not volunteer for that assignment, let me tell you.
Don't want.
And then... After TNG, Deep Space Nine kind of sidesteps the Prime Directive by, partially because they're a space station, people are coming to them as opposed to the other way around.
There is one that I would consider a Prime Directive episode.
Oh, really?
Gosh, what was it called? I think Shadows was in the name of the title.
Shadows.
The word shadow was in there, I think. It was the one where it was Dax and Odo on a runabout. And they pick up some sensor reading somewhere, and they go check it out, this planet, they go to it, and they beam down, and it's like this village, and there's this guy there that greets them. It's like, hey, what's going on? Why are you here? There's been people disappearing.
Is that the one where the entire village ends up being a hologram?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that episode. You really think that counted as a Prime Directive episode?
Well, that's what I wanted to discuss, actually. Because it is, in fact, just a, you know, computer construct that's projecting this hologram all over this area, part of the valley, whatever it is, being run by this old guy who's going to kick the bucket probably in the next like year or two anyway. He knows that his health is failing, all that stuff. But there is, in fact, a culture there that is being developed by the computer program as it's going, right? Like, this is explained, like, you know, Taya, which is one of the children there who befriends Odo, is a blending of the mother and father, right?
Right.
But she wasn't a initially programmed character in the holodeck or anything like that, or this hologram program, right?
No.
It was something that had to be created by the program, right?
That episode reminds me of a game of Dwarf Fortress gone bad. I'm just saying, you know, this just seems like something that would happen in Dwarf Fortress.
Right, so despite it being a computer program, this is definitely a culture that's being developed and is advancing in some way as it's going along.
Right.
Right, so does the Prime Directive apply to these holograms?
That's a hard question. I mean, I mean...
This is something that gets addressed a lot more in Voyager.
Right,
you know, in regards to, like, holographic rights and all that good stuff, but... Or I guess slave rights, or whatever you want to call it. But because they're computer programs, does that mean that they're not afforded the same rights and privileges that the Prime Directive would afford any other culture, despite them being a computerized holographic culture? as opposed to a flesh and blood culture.
Right. Well, to be honest, if the situation, if we were going to try to apply the Prime Directive to that episode, it's kind of a weird one to apply it to. They don't seem terribly concerned with the Prime Directive before they find out that it's a holographic like village. They're just like, oh.
Well, I don't recall a discussion about the Prime Directive coming up at all.
No, I don't.
In the show.
They're just like, okay, yeah, we'll help you look for your missing peoples. and then, of course, they find out that it's a holographic thing, and that's a clear.
Well, they tell them that they're holograms, I think, later,
yeah.
Don't they?
Yeah, I think they tell them. Hey,
guys, by the way, guys, you're a computer program.
Which is kind of important for them to know, because they need to be able to maintain the computer that, like, you know, generates all of them. It would kind of suck if one of them accidentally tripped over the power plug because they didn't know what it was.
My bad, guys. Whoops, oh, not here anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, and in that episode, it's, you know, in that, it's clearly, like, they feel. That episode's not really so much an interference thing. I mean, they definitely feel that this culture has the right to continue existing. And so I guess you could argue that that's violating the Prime Directive. Although, to be fair...
Right, but they interfere by fixing the machine.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know... So they're DS9 clearly operates by TOS-style Prime Directive as opposed to TNG-style Prime Directive. And I think that's supported by a couple of other episodes where, even though they don't directly mention the Prime Directive, that's how they act towards other species. Like the Hunted, I think, is the one where Tosk shows up.
Yep.
And that's the one where they are, you know, their official rule in that one is not to interfere because it's, you know, the sovereign activities of another species, and Tosk isn't asking for help. And that's a big thing in DS9 is that, like. And in certain better Next Generation episodes, that if one person, that you're allowed to interfere if one party asks you to. Because, like, at that point you're coming in to stop the oppressive treatment of another. Like, you know, like in the one, like in the TNG episode, I can't remember the name of this one either, but it's the one where Laxana Troi falls in love with this guy who's from a planet that kills you when you turn 60. And she's like, Picard, you have to do something about
this. The episode's called Half a Life, but yeah. I remember what the name of the planet is.
Right, well...
There's stars dying.
Yeah. Well, yeah, basically, Troi tells Picard that he has to do something about it, and Picard's like, well, I can't because, you know, Prime Directive. But then the guy requests asylum because he doesn't want to die. He's decided he wants to live, and Picard's like, okay, you get asylum because, you know, you feel that the laws of your planet are unjust. And we're not going to force you to go back and live under unjust laws.
Mm-hmm.
And DS9 sort of takes the same approach.
You know, it's actually interesting, that point. Maybe it's a question of scale, but we're back. Let's go back to TNG.
Okay, back to TNG.
Klingon Civil War.
Ooh.
All right. Ooh. One side's asking the Federation, hey, I got a problem. I need to fix it. It's the legitimate ruler, Gowron.
Yeah.
Is asking the Federation, hey, I need help because these guys are not, like, you know...
Because, yeah...
They're not following the law, and the Federation's like, nope, not gonna do it.
Right. Well, that's... And you see that in Deep Space Nine, too. In both of those, the Federation clearly doesn't interfere in the internal workings of other sovereign states. And I think that is a...
So what's being defined as internal working?
Yeah, that's...
Because half a life with Jameson, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
I think his name is Jameson. Or Timison?
Timison sounds more right.
Timison. Jameson's the admiral dude who was giving weapons to both sides back in season 2.
Right.
I think. Or season 1. One of the two. Anyway, I lost my train of thought. So Timison that whole situation is obviously an inner working thing because it's a very cultural, integral part of their society. When you reach 60... You get to go ahead and kick the bucket.
You die.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how healthy you are.
Because we don't want to visit you in a nursing home.
Yeah, exactly. I feel that's a pretty integral part of inner workings of society. Now, the point I'm getting to is that it seems more like a matter of convenience for the Federation is what it is, or the Prime Directive has become.
Yeah.
If it's something they don't want to deal with, they just say, nope, Prime Directive. Or something they do want to deal with, it's like, oh, but the safety of the Alpha Quadrant, oh my goodness, ooh-do-do.
See, I will... on that note,
it smells like this big convenience thing to me the Prime Directive in regards to the Federation.
In that instance, I'm going to disagree because when it comes to the Klingon, I think it's a matter of moral ambiguity because you see in the Asylum episodes, it's like an individual or a small group of individuals is being clearly persecuted by. you know, by the larger state. Whereas in the Klingon Civil War, it would actually be to the Federation's benefit to intervene, because clearly Gowron is more friendly to the Federation than the Duras family is, and it's, you know, the admirals all recognize that if the Duras house wins, that the Federation will be in a worse situation because they will no longer have allies as rulers of the Klingon Empire, and they refuse to intervene anyway. And I think that is clearly and you know, you could question how intelligent this policy is, but that's clearly that's clearly something that was put in the Prime Directive as a way to make sure that the Federation never meddles with, you know, with the sovereign affairs of another state in such a way that disrupts their society to benefit the Federation. Where it's like, you know, yeah, we could support one side for leadership over the other, and do what's best for us at your expense.
Okay, maybe the Klingon Civil War is a bad example. Let me throw this one at you. Yeah, the Pale Moonlight.
Ooh, well, that's clearly a violation of the Prime Directive right there. I do really love the Pale Moonlight, which, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is the one where Sisko tries to trick the Romulans into entering the war, and then in turn gets tricked by Garak, who double tricks the Romulans into entering the war by murdering one of their senators.
Yep.
In an awesome way. But, like, that episode, like, that's clearly a plot born of desperation, and it shows that the Federation, in the face of defeat by the Dominion, is willing to compromise the principles a little bit.
Yep.
And, you know, I can't really say I blame them. And then it shows that Garak finds their whole idea of morality silly and is like, no, I'm going to take this way farther, because I know your plan is silly and isn't going to work.
He wants a result, but what he wants is going to be a 50-50 shot. Let's go all the way. Yeah. All the chips on the table on this one.
Yeah, we are, you know, we're getting... Do you want to get things done, or do you want to sit on your moral high chair?
Yeah, exactly.
That's Garak's view on that. And in that instance, well, tell me a little bit more about what you meant. How do you feel the Prime Directive, like, works into that episode?
Well, the way we're seeing it portrayed in TNG is very much an absolute thing, right? And they can afford those kind of absolutes because the Federation is in a time of relative peace, right?
Right, right.
Things are going good. It's like they got the dot-com bubble going on like we had in the 90s, right? Mm-hmm. Business was booming, the economy was growing, you know, that's how the Federation, you know, had what their situation was with the Federation during the 2360s. They weren't at war with anyone. The Borg had come around a couple times, but they're like, you know, whatever, way far away.
Borg were more like a natural disaster than a threat from another nation.
Yeah, I mean, the Romulans are always around the corner, but they didn't really have any open confrontation with them. It's kind of more of a Cold War type situation with what it was.
Especially because of the
allies. The Klingons were their allies.
Well, and because the Klingons were their allies, the Romulans weren't that serious a threat, because it's like, you know, the Romulans were...
Well, right, no one was risking open warfare with the other,
yeah,
is what it was. Or they were playing a very close game of brinksmanship a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they were afforded the opportunity to be able to have the absolutes of the Prime Directive, right?
Right.
So if there was a situation they came across where they could get involved for no other reason just to say, hey, we got involved and we helped these people. Bajor is going to be a good example of this in a moment. But they don't, because they also want to get involved. They're like, no, that's too much work. We don't want to deal with that. We are morally upstanding individuals by saying we're not going to get involved in your nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to let this play out the way it's supposed to play out. Whereas, if the chips are down, like we see in the Dominion War during DS9, oh no, all bets are off. We don't need no Prime Directive right now. Right now, we need to get these things done, right? And Pale Moonlight's a good example of that, because Starfleet Command themselves were like, yeah, go ahead and get this done, Sisko. We need these Romulans in the war. And yeah, we like your plan, despite the fact that it kind of, you know, doesn't play with the rules of the Prime Directive at all. Despite that. Right, so it's just this really, I think the Prime Directive is a matter of convenience.
To an extent. Like, I mean, I think it shows... I think it shows that...
It gives them a free pass in any point in time where things are going good for the Federation, where they can just say, nope, don't want to deal with it. Because we don't want to.
And again, to an extent. But I also feel that, again, because I feel that the Prime Directive is a situation where the Prime Directive clearly limits the Federation's ability influence, because there are clearly a number of situations, the Klingon Civil War being one of them, where because of the Prime Directive, the Federation is not allowed to do things that would be to its direct advantage. They're not allowed to just take the resources they want from this planet,
right,
because even though it would benefit them, they could do it very easily. You know, they're not allowed to I don't know if the Prime Directive had anything to do with them developing cloaking technology, but that's another instance where...
That wasn't a Prime Directive thing. That was a treaty they had signed with the Romulans in 2311.
Right, that's another treaty, and they are unwilling to break that treaty, even though it would clearly benefit them to do so.
But they did anyway.
Well, one guy did. That was rogue operations, what that was, sir.
Well, it was Captain Pressman, and then some other people higher up in Starfleet Command and whatnot, mm-hmm. so...
But... See, and then in the Pale Moonlight...
And they tested it on Oberth, of all ships.
Well, you know, Oberth. But and then, of course, in the Pale Moonlight, they are in a situation where they can no longer afford that sort of thing. I don't feel that until Janeway's time that the Prime Directive is primarily... Like, I feel that the Prime Directive primarily limits the Federation as opposed to being an excuse not to do anything. Although with... That the big example, the big obvious.
What about the occupation, though?
Right, that's what I was about to say. That's the big exception, and it's not.
Yeah,
entirely...
that situation is very complicated. I will grant that, though, because they had just signed a treaty with Cardassia.
Do those dates line up?
They do, because we were talking the border skirmishes and whatnot go all the way from 2340 all the way actually well into the early 2360s. So I saw on the timeline anyway. These aren't canon timelines, mind you, but there's several timelines I've looked at that have them laid out this way. They sign a new treaty with Cardassia, which we first hear about in Season 4 of The Wounded.
Yes.
Good old Ben Maxwell.
Right, Maxwell, right? And O'Brien. O'Brien, who defeats Maxwell with songs, my favorite part of that.
Right, so, and then we start hearing about Bajoran occupation, all that good stuff, in Season... What was the... Was it Season 5 we saw Wesley Crusher at the Academy?
Yeah, and it was...
Because we see Cito Jackson for the first time.
Right, and we also
see... was Ro Laren before?
Yeah, Ro Laren is the one that first entered... When they were first still called the Bajora. I think that's Season 5. Maybe Season 6. They were setting up for DS9.
And that was, the first time we hear about Bajoran, like, occupation, all this good stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, it really feels like this situation has been created... To where, gee, guys, would really like to help, but we just signed a treaty with these guys saying we're not going to be pushing each other around anymore.
Right, but
clearly these people need help in some capacity.
But the dates don't quite match up, I don't think, because when DS9 starts, the occupation had been going on for 50 years.
Right.
And the border skirmishes had clearly ended much more recently than that. Because O'Brien, So clearly the border skirmishes were still going on when the occupation started.
Well, no, I wasn't saying that they weren't.
Oh, okay.
That's how I was saying it all. I was just saying the occupation had been going on, and I think the Federation would have had an opportunity to, like, arm Bajorans when the skirmishes were going. I'm like, hey guys, guess what? We're fighting a war with these Cardassians. You want to help?
Right.
I bet you would have gotten all sorts of Bajorans that would have been in on that in a second.
Yeah.
But they didn't, and it would have been very advantageous for the Federation to be arming these Bajorans... As the resistance, right? And, you know, arming the resistance to fight the Cardassians.
And you would think that because they were actively engaged in military conflict with the Cardassians, that the Prime Directive wouldn't stop them from doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the entire scope of the war would be. I mean, it sounds like it was just, you know, some skirmishes that happened on the border, is what it sounds like. At least that's what you've relayed to me, anyway.
Well, it sounds like it was border skirmishes, but it sounds like some of them were a fairly large scale. Like, they did have, like, fleet engagements.
Yeah.
And, like, there was never any full-scale invasion of territory on either side.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it is a little strange to hear that the Federation did, like, absolutely nothing about the occupation.
Yeah, and there are even Bajorans on planets that are not Bajor that Cardassia doesn't even control.
Yeah,
and they're not giving them, like, any help whatsoever.
Yeah, well, like, they established in the first episode with Ro that a lot of Bajorans, like, refugees are, like, social pariahs because they show up and basically have nothing, are, like, automatically become the poorest people in the area,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, just like in regular history, the poorest people are always the most hated, and get the most crap from everyone around them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Federation doesn't seem terribly interested in helping them, which, you know, I don't know, when the episode first started, like, I was just, even discounting replicators, let's assume replicators don't exist, I find it hard to believe that the Federation wouldn't be interested in giving aid to these people.
Well, right, this is where I think the Prime Directive kicks in, because they don't want to get involved whatsoever with them.
I guess.
Because it's a Cardassian-occupied world. Right, and that would have been interfering with the internal affairs of another culture.
But at that point, would it...
sovereign state.
At that point, I'm even confused, because I mean, I'm just talking about the Bajorans who live off-world, like the refugees who are, like, sort of migrating around the galaxy.
Aren't they technically subjects of Cardassia?
I don't know. That's kind of a weird gray area. like, there was never any indication that Cardassia was, like, trying to put them back on Bajor.
They were hunting down those that they thought were terrorists.
Right. So I guess there's maybe that. Maybe the reason they weren't giving them aid was because they were, like... Because the Federation
we don't want to be
like,
accused of aiding terrorists.
Yeah, I mean, that would, I guess, would make sense.
I mean, it's only when Picard needs information from, like, one of the Bajorans that he agrees to give him, like, blankets.
Right. And,
that's it.
And the guy even there even says, you know, man, if we'd known that being terrorists would have gotten us stuff, we should have started doing this a long time ago.
I know, right?
That episode is a little... I was just watching that, I was like, this is... a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, but it just seems so odd to me. You know, and it's probably because the idea had developed like afterwards, right? Because of how they decided to develop TNG and then DS9.
Yeah,
but it just seems so odd to me on a timeline because they're in a time of war when clearly arming an occupied people who were actively fighting resistance for what was it, 50 years?
Yeah.
Something like that, or they were occupied for 50 years anyway.
Yeah, it's unclear when the armed resistance came into full swing.
Right. But not arming them or helping them out in some capacity to fight someone who they're fighting in a war, despite the Prime Directive. You know, it just seems like the Prime Directive ties their hands behind their back so strangely in that situation.
I guess.
Because they decided to adhere to it for whatever reason.
And that's, I think...
But then immediately turn around in the Dominion War and be like, nope, all bets are off.
And that's just such a...
Granting that the Dominion War was a much more desperate situation.
Yeah, and I think that that has a lot to do with the fact that the story about the Border War was written without considering the story they were then going to write about the occupation. So mm-hmm. I don't think that was something the writers planned. I think that was just a weird, like, lining up of events, and now we're trying to make sense of it. I've always had a secret theory that the reason why Starfleet always seems so unwilling to help the Bajorans is because they don't like Bajor's religion. Because, like, Starfleet seems kind of... Like, the Federation is effectively an atheist utopia. Like, you know, if there is religion, it clearly doesn't play a big part in...
Well, they're still tolerant.
Yeah, I mean, they tolerate religion, but they don't... It doesn't play any part in their government. The vast majority of citizens are not openly religious. They don't seem to have any like religious holidays or anything like that. And then here you have Bajor, which is a society that is like defined by its religion in like every aspect of their life.
Yep.
And I've always suspected that there was a lot of resistance to allowing Bajor into the Federation and allowing them, you know, and helping them on like the Federation Council or what have you. Because of that, and the Federation was like, we don't really want to get involved with these guys, because to us here in our atheist utopia, every religion looks like a bunch of fanatics.
That sounds about right.
That's a possibility. I mean, that's something I can think of that might explain that mm-hmm. weird like that weird thing going on there.
Right.
And then of course, discounting the border wars, and of course, there's also the question of the Federation may have decided that arming the Bajorans would have been a bad idea, because it's possible that the Federation might have looked at it and taken the stance that if we give the Bajorans weapons, they will use them, and then the Cardassians will respond with greater force, and this will lead to an increased loss of life, and it's possible that the Federation was acting to preserve lives in the short term, which I would consider to be a very short-sighted strategy. but I could see that being possible. And then, of course, there's also the possibility that in real life history, where giving people who seem like the oppressed good guys a bunch of weapons has then backfired on us.
Yep.
And so it's possible that the Federation didn't want to deal with that.
I actually wrote my three Foundry missions are actually kind of that way.
Oh, cool. Speaking of which, I'm super excited to hear that Star Trek Online is going free to play.
It is going free to play.
I'm totally going to play it after there's, once it's free.
I don't know if all the details are posted yet.
Right.
But,
assuming that I don't get sent to the ghetto for playing free to play.
Again, I don't know if there's going to be something like that where it's going to say, no, you're not allowed to have Foundry missions. But anyway, Moving on, there wasn't, what else, did we have anything else in DS9 that was Prime Directive related?
There are a couple of episodes, but DS9's relation to the Prime Directive, they don't really ever say the word Prime Directive very often. They're more about, like, I think DS9 embodies the best part of the Prime Directive, where they're like, they don't interfere in the affairs of other governments because it's their it's their right to sort out their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the goal of DS9. But if one, you know, but if they are asked to intervene, then they'll think about doing it if the situation calls for it.
Right.
Then we get to Voyager, which is like everything that TNG was doing, but worse. especially because of Janeway's like bizarre interpretations of the Prime Directive, which I have to wonder if, like, I don't even really know where that came from. Like, looking at TNG, I can see where Gene Roddenberry's whole thing came from, even if that may not be the actual reason, but I can theorize as to why he did the things he did. I have no idea why they went the way they did in Voyager. My only guess is that they were, because Voyager was all about copying from the Next Generation, my theory is that they just looked and were like, oh, the Next Generation was doing this, let's do it some more.
Let's do it some more.
But because there wasn't a lot of talent involved with making Voyager, they just ended up going like in a completely bizarre direction with it. Like, Time and Again, I think, is the first one where that really comes up, where Janeway, where they go to the planet that has been destroyed by Polaric energy,
mm-hmm.
and then they get taken, like, Janeway and Paris get taken back in time before the explosion, and Janeway's like, no, Paris, you will not warn these people, because if you have no idea what the you have no idea what the consequences will be.
And surely it's better than letting them all die.
Nah, bro, nah. Just cool your
jets.
Don't
tell them, that's an order.
Cool your jets, bro. And then, of course, we get, and in that episode, she does eventually end up stopping it, but only because she realizes that Voyager is actually the one that caused it. And it's like, oh, well, that's a little convenient. So if Voyager wasn't the direct cause, you'd be perfectly willing to just let all these people die.
Yep.
And then, of course, there's the even more direct example of that is Prototype, which is even weirder, because this is an example of one species, a sentient, advanced, post-warp species, asking for Voyager's help. And, like, not it's not that Voyager doesn't have the resources. All they need is for Voyager to help them reprogram the glitch in their programs that stops them from reproducing.
Right.
And Janeway says no, because you don't know, because she doesn't know what the consequences will be. And it's like, I guess that's true, but, I mean, by the same token, if, you know...
No, I never saw the episode. Or was the race at war with someone else? Or...
Well, the... Okay, so the episode ends up, like, arranging itself so that Janeway is right, because it ends up... What it is there's a race of robots that asks for their help, and then it turns out that the race of robots is fighting another race of robots, and that both of them...
Oh, lucky yes.
Yeah, and that both of them wiped out their creators, because their creators were fighting a war, and then they decided to stop fighting the war, and robots were like, nah, we want to keep fighting the war.
No, that's cool, guys, we want to keep fighting.
But, like, Janeway doesn't know that. She has no way of knowing that when she decides to turn them down, and she's not interested in finding out their circumstances or anything. She's just... Janeway is doing exactly what you were talking about earlier, where she's just like, no, I'm using Prime Directive as an excuse not to deal with this problem. Because, you know, I guess she's busy or something.
I'm busy flying home.
She's got too much to do.
I got 70,000 light years to trek through. And, I'm busy.
You know, I feel this is a little lame because I'm kind of just parroting what Sci-Fi Debris has already said, but the episode could just as easily have come together that the robots were the last, you know, vestige of an advanced culture that was in danger of completely dying out, because, you know, it could do just as easily.
Mm-hmm.
And Janeway still would have refused to help them, because she wasn't interested in finding out what they were doing or why. The only reason they even know about the robot war is because one of the robots takes matters into his own hands and kidnaps Torres.
Oh my goodness.
Who, for some reason, is really obsessed with the robot. We never really find out why. Because she's never really demonstrated a huge obsession with any other piece of technology or artificial intelligence or anything. but for some reason, she was really obsessed with that robot.
Huh, okay.
Yeah. So, like, Voyager just takes its Prime Directive really strangely, and I really don't know, like, what the purpose of that was, other than, like, in that episode, because we needed this episode to go for a little longer than it did, we needed to have Janeway saying no. And that's especially funny because, you know, as we've talked about before, the thing that originally strands in the Delta Quadrant is Janeway deciding to violate the Prime Directive by getting involved in the Kazon you know, Ocampa conflict.
Yep.
And it's, so it's like, Janeway, what are you,
where's your head at, Janeway?
What's your game, Janeway? What are you trying to accomplish by all this?
Okay, so we have prototype time again. What else we got?
You know, those are the two big ones that I'm thinking of when I think of Voyager Prime Directive episodes. There are others.
Mm-hmm.
Like the one where they find the Ferengi that were...
Oh, yeah, from the Barzon wormhole. Yeah, it's The Price.
Yeah, again, and that's...
From season 3 of TNG.
And that's another episode. That's just... This is more of a Janeway is really bizarre flip-flopper than anything about the Prime Directive, because the Prime Directive sort of... apparently states that in this situation you're not supposed to get involved.
Right.
Even though you think it would... Because, I don't know, I feel like it would be mitigated by the Ferengi, who are not from that planet, getting involved first. But apparently not.
I know, right? It doesn't matter.
But
it's then, cool, bro.
But there Janeway decides that she's gonna, like, bend and twist to find a way to get to involve herself anyway, because she's so mad at these Ferengi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be fair, the Ferengi are being jerks, but they're not... being, you know, genocidal, wipe out an entire species jerks.
They're making profit.
They're making a bizarre profit.
It's true. Well, they're living it up on the planet they're on.
Yeah, but that's the episode where they're like, they want to go back for all of... That's the episode where they, like, for some reason, they want to go back for all their local currency. And it's like, that local currency is going to be worthless when you leave the planet. It's true. It's not going to matter. It doesn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, because that wasn't the original intent, I don't think. Because they had, I think, been... Or they took solace in the fact they were stuck in the Delta Quadrant, like, forever and ever, and they weren't actually going to ever get home.
Right.
At all, and they were just living it up on this planet, is what they were doing, I think, is what it was.
That was what they were doing. But then, when they are, like, leaving the planet, they want to go back for their money. Like, they have this big chest of local money, and they want to go back for it.
Gotcha.
And it's like, what? No. I mean, it would... I guess maybe I could kind of see them going back for some of the riches that they have, but I can't imagine that stuff's very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, it's metals and stuff.
Right.
And even if this is an episode where gold is really valuable as opposed to being worthless, it's can't be that high quality. I mean, it's like, you know, stuff that a bunch of pre-Bronze Age people made. But, you know, but those are... Time and Again and Prototype are really the two quintessential Voyager or Prime Directive episodes that really illustrate what the mindset of the Prime Directive in Voyager was and why so many people think it's a really silly thing.
It is a silly thing.
And then, of course, we get to Enterprise, which has Dear Doctor, which we've talked about before, which quite clearly the most ridiculous application of the Prime Directive I have ever witnessed. even though the Prime Directive doesn't actually exist yet. That's basically Archer and Phlox's entire justification for what they do is that it's not right for them to interfere. And again, we have this callback to the idea that, like, nature has a plan. And can you imagine if they switched that episode up just a tiny bit and they substituted the word nature for God? Can you imagine how mad people would have been if Archer and Phlox had been allowing this civilization to get wiped out because they thought God was telling them to?
I think there'd probably be a lot of words to be had on a lot of different places, like the internet.
I mean, you know, to be fair, there are a number of people who are upset about Dear Doctor as it is, but a lot of other people see it as a fine episode. I was reading one review site where it was given 4 out of 5 stars, and
intriguing.
I was like, oh my goodness. Because, you know, because... And I think that's because this idea that nature will work itself out is something that a lot of people sort of think because they haven't thought about it too much and they haven't realized that, you know, attributing nature with this intelligence of its own is basically the exact same thing as making it a deity. You are making it a supernatural entity which has more power than a person. That's basically what a god is. But because nature doesn't have the same associations as the word god, it doesn't register. But... Now I want to rewrite that episode, or just go and I want to go and redub the episode and replace all the times when Phlox is talking about letting nature run its course with him talking about how God wants him to let these people die. And I want to distribute that episode on the internet. Bob, make it happen.
I don't know if I want to get involved with that.
No, come on.
I think that's a thing you can put your name on, but not mine.
Come on, it'll be great. I will make sure all things Trek is on every screen.
I mean, because saying God, I mean, because God is an identifiable entity in person. I guess maybe person would be the wrong word to use. But something that has its own whim and wills.
Yeah.
I think is what the identifier would be, where as opposed to saying letting nature take its course, I don't think it's, I don't register as being that synonymous.
See, it seems exactly the same in this instance to me, and I want to make it absolutely clear that I'm not passing judgment on religion or faith or anything like that. That is not my place to say anything about. But I think that in this instance, it effectively works out in the same manner because they are attributing nature with having a will of its own and having a plan, as it were. Yeah. And it's the same thing, and you see the same thing in Voyager, this idea that the Prime Directive has a plan.
The Prime Directive has a plan.
And I feel that it's the same way, that's basically the same thing as attributing random things happening to an act of a god and saying that, saying that, like, nature will work this out is basically saying that God will work this out, except you've swapped out a word. And again, this is, I for people who are super into Star Trek reviews, this is also a theory that has been posited by SF Debris. I don't want to sound like I'm just ripping stuff off here.
But you are fond of SF Debris.
I do really like SF Debris. Man, I wonder if SF Debris is ever going to listen to us. That would be rad.
Whee! You send him an email like, hey, you listen to our show?
I will. I'll send him an email and be like, hey, you should check us out because we check you out and we think you're rad.
There you go.
But anyway, that's the note that Enterprise ends the Prime Directive on. Is this, let an entire species wipe itself out because we don't want to interfere, because that will be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's all, even discounting all this really high, like, philosophical stuff we've been saying, there's the fact that Phlox's argument makes no sense whatsoever, and is a completely mangled view of evolution.
And then someday, we'll come up with a doctrine on how to deal with things out here.
Some kind of directive. That made me, like, shiver when he said that. I was just like, oh, why? Thanks, Archer. But there's another Enterprise episode, which is a little less insane, where they, like, get captured by, a group of pre-warp, like, military dudes on another planet, and they basically decide to, they decide that rather than letting these guys who have captured them know that they're aliens, they just say that they're from the other faction on the planet.
All right.
And, the whole idea is that they're trying not to interfere, but then when they get rescued, it's pointed out, well, now you've interfered anyway. Now they think that the other faction is, like, five times more advanced than they are.
Yep.
So that's, that's going to cause some problems.
Yep.
Not sure exactly what kind of problems it'll cause, but definitely some problems.
It's going to make that particular side that is not the advanced one, quote-unquote, where the ones that had captured, like Archer and them,
mm-hmm.
probably have to use all their bluff at the governing table.
Yeah, probably.
Guys, they got, like, laser beams and stuff. Play it cool.
And then suddenly one side capitulated to the other for reasons we not entirely understand.
Not quite
we
sure.
We still really don't know what was going through their minds at that point.
Not quite sure.
Alternatively, it might cause the faction who thinks the other one is more advanced to launch a preemptive strike, because Archer and his people do say that all this advanced stuff is prototypes. So they might decide, oh, we have to attack now before it becomes, standard issue.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. We are an hour 20 into this.
We are, and I think we've about gotten as much as we can out of the Prime Directive. And I was, my general verdict on the Prime Directive is that it's cool when it's cool, and then it's really dumb when it's dumb.
I think it's become more and more inflexible over time, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a thing that has been discarded, though, when it's very inconvenient.
Numerous times. I'll be interested to see if this potential new Star Trek series, assuming it actually happens, if they actually decide I'll be interested to see how they handle the Federation, assuming the Prime Directive, and if they decide to handle it at all, or if they'll go the Deep Space Nine route and sort of just, like, use it but not invoke it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, I think that's about it for this week, and I want to thank everyone for listening.
I don't.
You don't?
No.
Why?
Because I want them to listen next week.
You want them to listen next week? Okay. Yep. And you think the way to get them to do that is by not thanking them for this week?
Well, if I thank them now, then they won't be able to hear me thank them later.
Oh, okay. Well, tune into us next week and Bob will thank you.
Maybe.
Maybe.
He's kind of one of those suspense things.
He's stingy with his praise.
That's right. What are we talking about next week?
I don't know. I feel like I should probably decide the sort of thing in advance.
Nah, that's cool.
You got anything you want to talk about?
Me? Well, we did come up kind of with this occupation thing.
talk more about the occupation.
Talk a little Trek history next week.
Talk Trek history?
Yeah, okay. I think we'll maybe highlight like the border wars actually a little more and the occupation.
Oh man, there is going to be so much of us like just hypothesizing about that stuff.
But I love that.
All right, well, I do like to nerd out. All right, so that's what we're going to be doing next week.
Do it.
All right, signing off.